and welcome to the 13th episode of Let's Talk Iran, providing Iranian-American perspectives on current events and policies that shape U.S.-Iran relations and affect the Iranian-American community. This program is brought to you by the National Iranian-American Council, otherwise known as NIAC. I'm Nobar Elmi, and I'll be your host. I'm here today with Reza Marashi. Reza is the research director at NIAC and is a former State Department official where he served under both the Bush and Obama administrations at the Iran desk. We're sitting down with Reza to talk about the current state of U.S.-Iran relations. Given all that's been happening lately, it's important that we take a step back to examine the threat of war and potential for diplomacy. Thank you, Reza, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
In a recent interview with BBC World, you state that on a scale of 1 to 10, when 1 being not likely and 10 being very likely, we are at a 7 when it comes to the threat of having a U.S.-Iran war. And if you ask me, that number is cause for concern. So can you please explain why you chose the number 7?
I think over 3 decades of institutionalized enmity and conflict is finally starting to boil over. The U.S.-Iran conflict has become like a powder keg, overflowing with sanctions and secret assassinations and computer viruses, threats to close the Strait of Hormuz most recently, and now we're seeing how a single incident can spark a wider conflict. And to make matters worse, there's no direct communication between the U.S. government and the Iranian government. And when you're not communicating, that increases the likelihood of misperceptions and miscalculations on both sides. Admiral Michael Mullen, who's the recently retired chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, put it best when he said that these misperceptions and miscalculations can quickly escalate into a conflict in the absence of communication. And I think that's where we're at right now.
Reza, in another interview, you stated that there are really only 2 options, that there's either go to war or engage in diplomacy, and that anything in between is just delaying the inevitable in order to gain leverage. Can you explain that idea a little bit more in detail, please?
When we look at the tools of statecraft, they're quite simple. We have military action and we have diplomacy. And anything else, whether it's called containment, sanctions, dual track, or a carrot and stick, is really nothing more than a tactic that delays the inevitable choice between these 2 options. And the inconvenient truth of statecraft is that every conflict, even war, ends via negotiations. And everything before negotiations, including war, is for leverage. And the effort to presumably delay this inevitable choice on Iran has only added pressure to escalate towards the worst outcome, which, in fact, is war. And I think our nation has learned the hard way in Iraq that after war comes the responsibility of reconstruction, or back together what you've broken. And the approximately $60 billion per year that America spends on foreign assistance does not include the total cost for reconstruction and stabilization efforts in Iraq. Total war-related funding for Iraq has reached almost $900 billion. That's an average of approximately $100 billion per year from the time of 2003 when we invaded the country until the present. But despite these staggering numbers, and at a time of nearly 10% unemployment and unprecedented government bailouts, those who publicly and privately push for war with Iran consistently fail to answer an important but very basic question, which is how will we pay for it? It's no coincidence that many of the same politicians and pundits who led us into the Iraq War are now recycling these disproven and dangerous arguments to make a case for war with Iran. So as America continues to pull itself back from the brink of economic collapse, making the case for another war on borrowed money, in my view, is morally, fiscally, and politically irresponsible. And of course, I think it goes without saying that the Iranian people are the biggest losers in this scenario. Because of how increasingly poor the Iranian government is treating its own people, some of us can get lost in legalities and lose focus of the fact that war is the most egregious human rights abuse of them all.
You know, you mentioned some of the pundits and some of the people who are responsible for the Iraq war are now recycling some of those same arguments in order to, you know, perhaps go to war with Iran. Can you give me some specific examples of that?
Sure. Well, I think that the formula is to acknowledge up front that war is horrible, war is a last resort, nobody wants it, but then you quickly turn to making arguments about how everything else has been tried and it's not working, and how, you know, maybe war wouldn't be such a difficult thing, about how, you know, surgical strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities could be done rapidly and effectively when, in fact, there's no such thing as a surgical strike. You're going to end up bombing something that's near civilian infrastructure, and innocent people end up getting hurt along the process. So what ends up happening is you acknowledge the high risk, the high cost, but then you actually present a rosier scenario to say maybe it wouldn't be so bad. And then you end by saying, unfortunately, we're running out of options. And so, you know, you don't want to hit the war argument too fast. You don't want to call for war too quickly. It's almost like you have to lead people there. You have to lead a horse to the water before it drinks, as the idiom goes. And I think that's where we're at now, where people at first were saying diplomacy with Iran can't work. Then they said we need to sanction Iran. Then they said sanctions on Iran aren't enough. We need more sanctions. Now these newest sanctions apparently aren't enough, and they haven't even been enacted for longer than a few weeks. And that inevitably leads to the call for, well, we tried sanctions, we tried diplomacy, they haven't worked, both of which arguments are false, and then they make the false argument for war. And it's increasingly dangerous. That's what we're starting to see now. And as we get deeper into the election season here in the United States, I think we're going to see more of this in a more detailed fashion, all of which will be founded on principles that are illogical at best and dishonest at worst.
So you brought up exactly what was my next question. You're talking about the campaign season. Things are already difficult when it comes to U.S.-Iran relations, but you throw in there the fact that we're about to have a U.S. presidential campaign, and it makes it even more difficult. Do you think that the president or the GOP presidential hopefuls have the political space needed in order to make decisions that they want to make, or will they be pressured to play hardball in order to secure media sound bites?
That's a great question. I don't think political parties in the United States dictate the range of foreign policy options that are available to an American president. We're actually seeing this now because President Obama's current Iran policy really isn't that different than the Iran policy that President Bush left behind when his presidency came to an end. What complicates things even more than usual is the fact that it's silly season now in both Washington and Tehran. Both capitals are fully in election mode, and U.S.-Iran relations are a divisive issue that can be used domestically by political factions looking to one-up their opponents. And there are politicians, both in Iran and the United States, that have made careers out of proving how nasty they can be to the other side. And I think this is short-sighted and destructive to the longer-term interests of both countries. Instead, decision-makers in Tehran and Washington need to put politics and the past aside. We're headed in a very dangerous direction with few off-ramps for those behind the wheel. And I think what's needed now more than ever is someone brave in both Washington and Tehran to take risks for peace. And I'm hoping that the adults in the room will do exactly that.
Thank you, Reza. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but you can follow Reza on Twitter at R-E-Z-A-M-A-R-A-S-H-I. That's Reza Marashi. And as always, please be sure to visit NIAC online at www.niacouncil.org.